Have you ever been driving in your car on the way to a meeting and so many voices in your head are talking to you all at once? So much so that you want to tell all of them to be quiet? And have you ever wondered if this is normal or that maybe you're coming undone just a bit? And where do all those voices come from? How did they get in my head in the first place? Stay with me for this next hour for answers to those questions and for some explanations as to how to change all that noise into insights and reclaim our banished voices. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. We thank you for listening and for being a part of our world. And before we get on with the show, as they say, a heartfelt and sincere thanks to an important and valued Mrs. Green's World partner, Tucson Medical Center. TMC has been Tucson's locally governed nonprofit regional hospital for more than 70 years. Their mission is to provide exceptional care with compassion, and they aspire to serve our community by being the best health system as measured by the quality of care they deliver, the experiences they create, and the value they bring. I believe we're truly blessed to have them serving our community, and I mean that. Okay, Reclaiming Banished Voices, a case for compassion. So ready to welcome our guests to talk about this complex and somewhat intimate subject. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lawrence Lincoln. He has been the medical director of Tucson Medical Center Hospice for more than 25 years and recently retired from a clinical medical disease practice and is the author of a truly insightful and impactful book, and trust those words coming out of my mouth, Reclaiming Banished Voices, Stories on the Road to Compassion. Larry, it's wonderful to have you back in the studio once again, and I thank you for being here and for showing up in my life. So how's that for a welcome?
Thanks for having me.
It's so true. I'm a little bit overly enthusiastic, I think. And for our listeners, you might be wondering how this topic fits into being disruptors for good and working for a sustainable and socially just world. And what does this topic have to do with climate change and global warming? It was an easy one for me to decide to do this interview. Sustainability and awareness about the shape the planet is in starts from within and from learning how to sustain our bodies, our minds, and our spirits. It starts with how to be compassionate with ourselves, with our families and our friends, and yes, even with trying to be compassionate with those we believe to be our enemies. Very challenging times right now, I think most of us would believe. So just press pause here for a minute and think about the shape our country is in. The hatred and the vitriol and the divisiveness, and I know that I'm a part of that. It's pretty scary out there if you think about it. And on a personal level, it's interesting and noteworthy to me that the day we are recording this podcast is the day the hearings began for the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh as the next Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. The decision will change the course of history for many years to come, and I am saddened and terrified at the lack of respect for the process and for our rights as American citizens. And I believe Joe Biden said the soul of our country is at stake. And I'm being upfront and honest about that, possibly because of reading this book. So what better time to have someone with me who has worked on helping us to have compassion for ourselves first, and then maybe, just maybe, figure out how to walk in the shoes of those we dislike or hate or have not a modicum of respect for and try to understand their path. So no pressure, Larry. That's all I'm asking you. That's all right. I'm asking you to take care of, okay? It's not a big one. So I think let's start out with some general questions. What compelled you to write this book in the first place? It is a profound book, and I don't want to be over dramatic. I can't be. What made you do it?
I think it was 9/11 that made me do it.
Actually. Wow.
The day after 9/11, I wrote an email to President Bush, pleading with him not to react right away, but to sit with the grief and let our friends all over the world offer support to make changes so that we didn't just repeat cycles of revenge and retaliation. and tit-for-tat violence. And I knew this had very little to do with what President Bush was going to do, but I had to write it for myself.
Right, right.
That was in the setting of over 15 years of work with a woman named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who was famous for her work with Death and Dying, but also did a whole another type of work that began with The Dying that I became involved with.
I mean, tying it to 9/11 is profound. I mean, I had no idea. I actually think I did read in the book about your writing to President Bush, and I'm assuming you did not get immediately called to the White House.
No.
But you did it. That's the most important thing to me. And this time now, you did it. You let your voice be out there for consideration. Okay, so it's 255 pages of complex, compelling, heartfelt, impactful, and important content that I believe everyone listening should consider reading. And that's from my heart. What would you tell them the book is about? I was trying to get my head around that. Like, what can I say to people? What's it about? And why is it applicable to everyone?
Well, there are really multiple themes. The theme of the title of the book, Reclaiming Banished Voices, goes back to what I've learned after working with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross for 30 years and doing her work for 30 years. And what I learned was that when we're young, if we're neglected or hurt, the safest way to respond to that often is to take responsibility for our hurt or neglect.
Like blame ourselves?
We blame ourselves,
okay,
because it's too dangerous to blame our parents or our friends,
right,
or other people. And if we're not allowed to process an injury at the moment and get some safety around it and some understanding about it, then we shove it inside and then we decide that it must be our fault. And so at the same time that we're little and vulnerable on the one hand, we suddenly become all powerful on the other. And the world is our fault. When I was, the story I'm going to tell now is really the beginning of the book, and I didn't learn about this consciously until I attended one of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's workshops. When I was 5 years old, I grew up in a kind of a lower middle class neighborhood. It was post-war row houses, lots of kids running around. As it turns out, many of them were older than I was. I was kind of the youngest boy in the neighborhood, except for one other five-year-old who lived down the block and up the block, which is a long way away when you're five.
Right.
So there were probably 20 kids between the ages of 6 and 12 that hung out together, fought with each other, played baseball and football, tackle football with each other. And mostly I watched because I was so small, and also I wasn't a gifted athlete, as opposed to my brother, who was just 15 months older, who was. One day, it had rained the night before, and so our field was mud. So there was no really place to go and play. So maybe 15 or 18 kids were hanging out on the street, on my street, actually. And they were bored, as you would expect. And at one point, they began pushing and shoving each other. And then the next moment, I think an 8 or 9-year-old screamed, "Nigger pile." And they grabbed the other 5-year-old who was watching from the other side of the group and threw him on the ground and jumped on him and piled up on him. That's what it meant. Now, I use the N-word because that's the word they used,
right,
obviously. And, of course, it was a completely segregated neighborhood. There wasn't a black person anywhere in sight, and I didn't even know what the word meant, but all I knew was that this other five-year-old was thrown on the ground and they piled on, and he screamed, and then I couldn't hear screams anymore because so many kids were piling on. And it went on for a long time, at least from my five-year-old memory. And the top kids on the top fell off the pile, and then they would run and jump back on the pile, and this went on and on. And finally, the kids in the middle of the pile got tired of being jumped on, so they pushed everybody off. And when everybody got off the pile, this little boy didn't move. And if they all ran away because they knew, you know, something wasn't right.
Right.
So they took off, and I was frozen there, terrified and humiliated because I didn't do anything to stop it. And after a while, finally, he moaned, and he moved, got up. He walked down the street, and I never saw him again. And I already knew at five that, God bless my parents, they did the best they could, but if I went home and told my father about it, he would tell me how rough and tumble his neighborhood was and that I should just be tough and get out there.
Right,
and
toughen up, Larry.
Exactly. Yeah. And my mom would have been so scared. She was an orphan. She would have been so scared that she would have gotten angry with me. So I knew to keep my mouth shut. So I shoved all this down. And I was so scared that it was going to happen to me that I just, at the same time I was terrified, I shoved this memory down, and I also swore that nobody was going to mess with me ever.
Right, right.
And so I buried a very tender, gentle little boy, and internally became a very angry, determined kid that wasn't going to be pushed around. Now, I wasn't going to be like them, so I was going to be a gentle, kind kid at the same time, but I was going to show them. And so for the next 32 years, I was showing a bunch of kids in my neighborhood that I was going to be better than they were, and it drove me in many ways to be a very successful and accomplished physician. But on the other hand, I was, by the time I saw Elizabeth Kubler-Ross for a second time, I was exhausted.
And that was Teddy. And I told you before, I think we should do full disclosure. I called you this morning because I was what I would call in a state. Lots of voices were talking about perfecting this interview, which we can't. It will be what it will be. You calmed me down. I asked you if we'd come a little bit early. And then I said to myself, because I read the book, what is going on, Gina? What's going on with you? And what was going on with me is my desire to share this with people because I am a helper. I am a caregiver. I care about people. So I want to give this book to people I love because it helped me so much. I want to spread the knowledge and the wisdom and the insights. And I just you said the perfect things. This show will evolve as it is supposed to. We'll cover what we can. So the questions might be a little bit all over the place, but there is so much wisdom in what you shared about you had no idea that Teddy shaped your life for a significant part of it. None whatsoever. That voice was, you put that in a lock and threw away the key in a box and the workshop.
Teddy, by the way, Teddy was the other five-year-old.
Oh yeah, we didn't name him.
Exactly.
See, that's, yes, Teddy, help Teddy me out here with this.
Other five-year-old. And so I put Teddy in Teddy was already buried under the pile, but what I did was I buried myself at age five.
Right.
To become and allow another part of myself to take over, which in many ways was useful, but in many ways it wasn't.
Right, right. And to be able to get that. And I also told you that I didn't feel like reading the book. And it wasn't anything about you. It was about me. It's like, oh my gosh, it's a weekend off. I left it to the last minute. All those voices of, you know, do your work and then go enjoy yourself. That's how I live. And I read the first few pages and I was hooked. I closed the door to the bedroom and I came out for food to use the restroom because it gets you. if you are on a path to spiritual and emotional health and well-being, the book gets you. And it was the Teddy story. It's like, I have to know what happens to you because of what you saw with Teddy. And this was just in the preface, no less. The whole story, I'm like, am I still on the preface and making all these notes? So I'm not sure where to put this in, but how did that day literally lead you to the Growth and Transition Workshop Program at TMC? It's like, follow the yellow brick road.
Right. So I have to go back to 1969. I was in medical school. I had taken a year off between the first two scientific years with lectures and courses in anatomy and pharmacology and physiology and the clinical years, because I was a perfectionist, of course, after Teddy. And so I did a year of autopsies. And I just so happened to see this brochure that this woman, Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, was coming to speak at Columbia Medical School about death and dying, that she'd just written this book. And I thought, well, I've seen a lot of dead people, but sometime in my career, I may see somebody who's in the process of dying.
Right.
So I should go listen to this woman. And Elizabeth told stories. You know, she was a great storyteller, and it was so refreshing, because Columbia was a very conservative medical school, and she talked about people and not about diagnoses.
Right.
I rushed out and bought her book, but I was too busy to read it. And 14 years later, in 1983, when I was making rounds at TMC, at 4:30 in the morning, I saw this flyer saying she was coming to speak. And this was by 6 a.m. I called the person and woke the poor person up, because I'd been working for 2 hours.
I was cracking up when I read that part. It's like, hello?
And bought tickets for my wife and a couple who'd lost a child. And she was talking about accepting one's own death. And I heard a voice in me say, that wouldn't be a bad idea. Then I could start working 15 hours a day and just be Larry again. I had no idea who that voice was.
Right, right.
My younger partner and I used to talk about it at the end of our days. You know, working 12, 14-hour days, we'd take a few minutes and shake our heads at each other and say, we can't keep doing this for 30 more years. But the next day, we would start and do it again. I was out in the parking lot after Elizabeth's lecture, and that voice said, nah, we're not leaving. You're going back in there to talk to her. So I said to Anne, and again, I had no sense of that the voice even existed, but I said to Anne and my friends, I said, excuse me, but I have to go back in there for a second. Do you mind? And they said, okay. So I went back in. She was signing her books. I pushed my way through the whole crowd. I mean, this is not Dr. Lincoln.
This is out of character.
Out of character.
Dr. Lincoln.
I pushed my way through, and I bent over and whispered in her ear, thanks for how peaceful you made me feel. And she looked at me and stood up to all 4 feet, 11 of her, and she grabbed this brochure and said, she's Swiss, you come by to my next workshop. And she shoved this in my hand. And I went home, and that same voice made me fill it out at 11 o'clock at night, write a check, a deposit check, and maybe drive in the car to a post, to a mailbox, and put it in the mailbox, because that voice knew that Dr. Lincoln would wake up the next day and
just put it on the pile.
Put it on the pile.
Just put it on the pile.
Just move on.
Yep, not make such an emotional-based decision. So it was like,
right.
Will the real Larry Lincoln please stand up? Because so, there were lots of them there.
Exactly. And so I attended her workshop 4 months later. After trying to get out of it, I had signed up for the workshop 2 months later, but I was too busy to go, but they wouldn't let me out of it. So I came in 4 months, and then it was at that workshop that I, in other people sharing, that voice appeared in a way that I had to listen.
Right, right. And I want to talk about your skepticism. We're going to take a very short break. And when we come back, I think it's important to just give kind of the bird's eye view of what the purpose of the growth and transition workshops were. We can't describe the whole thing, but everybody, please stay here with me. There's a lot more really important information to cover, exciting, impactful, and an invitation to all of you. We'll be right back. Stay here with me.
Please join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. You can also find us on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and SpeakUp Radio. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or others, please write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But now, back to our story.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thank you for joining us. Reclaiming Banished Voices, a case for compassion, but compassion for whom is the question? With me to share what this is all about this hour is Dr. Lawrence Lincoln, the medical director of Tucson Medical Center Hospice for more than 25 years and recently retired from a clinical medical disease practice. He is the author of a truly insightful and impactful book. If I haven't made that case, I'm making it again. Reclaiming Banished Voices, Stories on the Road to Compassion. A graduate of Amherst College, Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeon, he and his wife, Anne, offered the growth and transition workshop for 31 years. So it must have stuck, Larry. They have two children and three grandchildren who have blessed their lives in many ways that are shared in the book, which, of course, I am encouraging every single reader, listener to get your hands on the book as soon as possible. So, Larry, I know I sound like a commercial for your book, but I feel like I'm doing a service to people, to everyone I love. So thanks for being here. So can you give us a brief overview, first of all, of what happens in the workshops, and then talk about, I want to know, like, who comes to them, and give me some general sure. observations, and then how it's changed your life
right.
and continues to
right.
change your life.
So Elizabeth wrote a book called On Death and Dying. That's Elizabeth Kubler Ross. She became world famous overnight by that book and began to give lectures and then began to do workshops for the dying. And caregivers were bringing workshops to the dying. And basically, they would sit on the floor for 5 days. And Elizabeth would ask questions, and people would respond. And oftentimes, there would be a lot of tears, but also a lot of rage for past injuries that the dying had never resolved, and which were preventing them from living the last days of their life fully. It soon became clear that the caregivers often needed the workshops more than the dying. And so Elizabeth opened up her workshops, which she called Life, Death, and Transition Workshops, to everybody. By 1983, when I applied, the workshops were going all over the country, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and Europe. And they were filled with maybe a third of the people that have life-threatening illnesses, third professionals who wanted to see this magical woman do her work because she was so gifted, and a third of the people that were just growing. My adult self would have preferred to go to Hawaii for 5 days than to the workshop, but this other part of me demanded that I go, so I have to be on call the weekend before. I got into a van, and I drove my car to the airport, flew to San Diego, got into a van that took me to San Luis Rey Mission, where this workshop was going to be. And I remember getting out of the van, and I could feel a bead of sweat running down my back, and knowing that this was not going to be a medical, scientific conference. When I arrived, people greeted me called me Lar, and everybody was happy, and I thought, oh no.
Kumbaya.
Kumbaya, exactly.
I'm out of here.
Exactly. There were communal bathrooms, and I'd been working 15 hours a day, taking care of people, and I wasn't even going to be able to go to the bathroom by myself. And so I was completely skeptical about this. When we started off, we began with singing. And thought,
oh, my gosh.
Yes, exactly.
I know people that would have exit left.
Absolutely. I was tempted. And so I sat two-thirds of the way back thinking I'll just watch. I knew not to stay in the front or get in all the way back because they would be obvious, either too eager or too frightened. So I hid. And there was some basic teaching. We did some spontaneous drawings, which were really interesting, that Elizabeth had us do. And with the spontaneous drawings, in a setting like that, are really another way to get to the unconscious. That went on, and then we did introductions, and people began to share their stories, and some of them were poignant and touching, and others were irritating to me. And by the end of the introductions, I was exhausted because I was being impacted from so different angles, sometimes with judgment, sometimes with sadness. And the next morning, Elizabeth did some basic teaching, and then she opened the mat up, and she would sit, and there was a twin mattress on the floor, and she said, the mat is open, and I didn't know what she was talking about. And a young woman came up to the mat and began to tell a story, and I didn't even know how she knew to come up to the mat. She began to tell a story about her beloved young mate who had developed cancer and who was given x-ray treatments and relapsed and was going to given some more treatments. And she had told the physician that he already was irradiated in that field, but the physician didn't listen. And so he was re-irradiated in a field that had received probably maximal radiation, and he was burned, and he had died, and he finally died from this overwhelming cancer. And she couldn't grieve because she was so
angry.
Oh. And so suddenly Elizabeth gave her a red rubber hose and put phone books out on the mat and said, talk to the doctor. And she just went, to my eyes, she went berserk with rage and just told this guy what he had done to her beautiful man. And then all this poured out, and it touched all of us. Many of us were in tears, and many of us were touched by the rage, because many of us had the same rage inside of us. And when she finished with all this rage, suddenly the tears came, and she began to talk, and Elizabeth gave her a pillow, and she began to talk to her man and was able to tell him how precious their time together was and who he was and say her goodbyes.
And you're witnessing this and saying, this is the real thing.
Yeah, this
profoundly
is
profoundly real,
yeah, this
intimate.
Is, right. Oh. This is, there's no BS here. And I'm in feelings about this, and at the same time thinking, this is really good for her. But there's no way on earth that I'm going to
so
get up there in front
that
of 91
yeah.
strangers and pour my guts out.
Right.
And so she finished, and then the next person came up. And then the next person came up. And the next person came up. And one after another, these touching stories about... And I look at these people, they look normal. And then you just, you know, you scratch the surface. And there, all these people, many of whom are professionals... You know, educated people out in the world.
Highly successful.
Yes.
Yes.
And carrying all this pain. And after about 4 or 5 hours of this, kind of right before dinner, there were 2 full days of this, Elizabeth passed me by and I grabbed her and said, Elizabeth, there's no way I can do that. And just in her typical way, she looked at me and said, after another 20 to 30 people go, you'll go.
She knew it.
Oh, yeah. She just walked away. She wasn't gonna bail me out.
This was not her first rodeo.
No. So the next morning, all I wanted was some peace. And I didn't know how I was going to do the next day. So the next morning, I took my breakfast and went to the far end of the dining room, which was huge, and sat facing the wall. Now, that's symbolic nonverbal language
right.
for...
Leave me alone.
Leave me alone.
Leave
and
me alone.
And wouldn't you know, before I could get my first spoonful of oatmeal in, this young woman comes and sits opposite me because she thinks, you know, I need company.
Like, you're lonely.
Lonely.
Yeah, look, nobody will sit with him.
Exactly.
So something good was inside of her.
Wonderful. And she was, and we had this very sane conversation. And I thought, okay, I'll hang out with her and I'll make it through the rest of this next day.
Right, you can hide next to her.
Of craziness, you know.
Right.
So we go in, we do our singing, we have a moment of silence. And then she looks at me and says, well, I'm a perfectionist, and if I don't go up now, I'll never go up. And she got up and went on the mat. And I thought I was set up, you know. And she got off the mat, and then after here I'd had this beautiful breakfast with this really nice teacher, and then she began to tell her story that I had no sense of, and I would not have any sense of. And it was very touching, and at that moment... my five-year-old perfectionist that came out of the ashes of Teddy's smothering said, well, if she can do it, I became a very competitive little boy. If she can do it, I can do it. And so I got up and motioned to Elizabeth and said, pointed at my own chest and said, I'm next. You know, while this my new friend is finishing her work. And Elizabeth nodded and said, okay. And a 5-6-year-old took me to the mat and then began to tell his story. And was able to get his rage out and his shame and talk about his shame. And I realized that I had been compensating for 32 years, compensating for my failure to help that other 5-year-old when he was almost killed. And I was making amends and atonement for what I didn't do.
And at that point, at 5-year-old, developmentally, you don't have the emotional intelligence to even cope or get your head around that.
No.
It's like someone that young that experiences seeing a tragedy or shooting or all those things, your coping skills are not up to speed at 5 years old.
Now, the irony is, had somebody said to me a month prior to the workshop, now, do you ever remember seeing some kids smothered by other kids? I would have said, yeah, but I would have not had any emotional
No attachment
to it. It wouldn't have registered because it was so far put away. But because of the other people who had the guts to share at the workshop, it touched the emotions attached to that event so that and when you're on the mat and you're angry, you're getting this anger out, there's a part that watches the whole thing. And so I was watching this little boy who happened to be me tell 91 strangers about what he went through and how terrified he was and how furious he was, and I got it. And I thought, oh my God, this is who lives inside of me. And at that moment, my prior response to myself for the last 32 years was, toughen up, don't be a wuss.
Right,
you know,
right.
Push
yeah.
on. If you have to start at 4 o'clock in the morning, start at 4 o'clock in the
right.
morning and keep working until your day is done.
Right. That's what you signed up for.
That's what I signed up for.
Yep.
And so I was able to reclaim that little boy and say, yeah, I see what happened, and I'm sorry. And I'm sorry you felt that way. And I'm going to take better care of you because nobody's taking care of you. And so I went home, and when it was my day off and people called me at home, I'd say, sorry, I can't see this next patient because I promised my two children that I'd spend the day with them.
Right.
And I began to say no, took the risk to say no. Some docs stopped referring to me when I did that, but I didn't become a bag man. You know, the world didn't come to an end. And I had more time with my children.
And your children got you, which is a forever thing.
It's a forever thing.
It's a forever thing, yes.
And I began to sleep, instead of 3 hours a night, I began to sleep 8 hours a night. So life changed after that substantially with that recognition. Now, I relapse, you know, because we were creatures of habit.
It's a process.
Yeah, it's a process.
It's a process.
And that was my first experience. And fortunately, I decided that I would train with Elizabeth, and then my wife Ann trained with her. She got her counseling degree, and we began to do weekend workshops. I asked Elizabeth to come to Tucson Medical Center, and we did a workshop in early 1986, which is the beginning of the Growth and Transition Program, which were weekend workshops based on Elizabeth's five-day workshops. And over the years, I've become revisited other losses in my life, met other voices in my life, and gradually reclaimed them as well.
And you listen to them. I mean, that's what I'm doing this book, and that's why it took me so long. I'm like, okay, who doesn't have voices talking to them inside? If they don't, I can't imagine. It's identifying it with the clarity with which you did was a different experience for me. It's like you're not crazy. Everybody's talking at once. I call it the committee.
Right.
And sometimes
exactly.
I say the committee. We all just be quiet.
And included in the committee can be somebody who's scared, an age where anger is predominant, grief predominance, emptiness predominance, shame predominates, and judgment. We have a judge that sits on our shoulders that can talk to us, yak, 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 yak.
Whisper, yeah, I want to kick that one to the curb.
Whisper in our ear constantly that we're never good enough.
Yeah,
we're never going to measure up, you know.
Right.
What have you done lately?
Right.
You know, the fact that you've had Mrs. Green's World for 10 years and given so much to the community because of this, but the judge says, so what's next?
Right. What are you going to do next? What did you do for me today?
Exactly.
And the thing, the introspection that requires leads me to the next question, kind of. You talk about the importance of an emotional and spiritual practice, which you have. You actually check in with those voices. You listen to them. And it's not like multi-personality disorder.
No.
They are life incidents that I think every honest human being could spend about a half an hour thinking about things that happened to them that hurt. And so emotional and spiritual practice, I want you to talk about that, why it matters so much that we do it, and then talk about things like unconditional love and how important is that. I mean, there's more here. It's not just the bad voices. There are other things that shaped you, that made you a loving husband and loving father and all of those good pieces. And for me, the same. It's like your honesty in the book was one of the things that impressed me the most because you are a well-respected physician. You're well-known in your profession around the country. And here you are just letting it all hang out, basically. I'm like, wow, dude, you're really letting us see it all, your interactions with your children and with your wife, very intimate and personal. So why don't we just take a very quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the emotional and spiritual practice. And I'd like you to talk about specifically that really poignant part about having someone who loves us unconditionally and identifying that person, because hopefully we all have that person. Everybody stay here with me. We're going deep here with Dr. Lawrence Lincoln. And I hope you're with me, and I hope you want to hear more, and we'll be right back.
Hi, it's Meredith, a proud member of the Mrs. Green's World team. We are disruptors for good, passionate game changers working to create a more sustainable, safer, healthier, and socially just planet for all. By creating podcasts like this one, we offer tangible solutions that inspire you to take action. We need your financial support to continue producing content, podcasts, film, and written works that engage, educate, and inspire our global community to fight climate change. Join us today. Visit MrsGreensworld.com and click Join the Movement.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for listening. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as always, we thank you for being a part of our world and for joining us. Our guest for this hour is talking about the voices in our heads that talk to us constantly. Where do they come from? Why is it important to listen to them? Please join me once again in welcoming Dr. Lawrence Lincoln. He has been the medical director of Tucson Medical Center Hospice for more than 25 years and recently retired from a clinical medical disease practice and is the author of a truly insightful book, impactful book. I kept trying to come up with the words. Reclaiming Banished Voices, Stories on the Road to Compassion. And Larry, thank you so much for doing it. And in the intro, I should have included that you're doing all that. You were working with infectious disease. You have this practice, the hospice care. And then you were doing these workshops with Anne for how many years? 31?
31.
31 years. So you were really busy.
You make it sound like I haven't learned anything.
That is not true. You were helping others learn from your, but it is an onion, a never ending peeling of the onion.
It is.
And there's always more layers. And I, for one, am excited. So I'm going to try and stay on track in this last piece. So I want to cover emotional and spiritual practice, unconditional love, my big question about the idyllic childhood and does it exist? And then try to circle back around to why it's important now more than ever in the history of our world with what's going on and the Israelis and the Palestinians. You make a reference to that. Why doing this work might help us lead, reading the book might help lead many of us to some type of common ground, and we're going to be the change that we want to see in the world instead of fueling the fire, which I am guilty of. So emotional and spiritual practice, why does it matter?
It's a big question.
It is a big question.
It's like, let's see how
I don't want to put you on the spot.
Well,
but
what's coming up for me is to say that If we don't pay attention to these voices, if we are not able to be introspective in some way, then and we ignore those voices, then they run the show. You know, so I would wake up in the morning and it would be a beautiful sunny day, and I would remember to look up at the Tucson Mountains and think that's why I'm here. And then I'd hit my first hospital, and things would be going fine. And then suddenly, a family member who flew in from Indianapolis the night before grabs me, and I'm 45 minutes late because I have to go through the whole thing with that person. And inside, I'm going nuts because 45 minutes is just the beginning, and this scared place inside of me says, You promised that we were going to have some time before dinner to exercise or play with the kids.
Not happening.
It's a lie. You lied to me again. And this, what I do then, I start rushing. I start being angry. I get frustrated.
Not fully present.
I get not fully present. I get quiet. I don't say hello to my nurse in the office. I say, what's going on? Because I'm already tense. And so the ripples occur all through.
Yeah, yep.
All through, and she gets tense, and she doesn't speak nicely on the phone to a patient who's scared, and so the ripples just ripple
out. Keep on going. Yeah.
And I get home at night, and I don't want to talk to Anne, and my kids are too loud. They're having fun playing, and it's too loud for me. Poor me.
Right.
And so I go.
What a hard day you had.
Right.
Which you did.
Exactly. And I go from victim to authoritarian to, and it's all this young voice that's taken over my life. And at the end of the day, I look in the mirror and think, what happened today?
Started out bright and sunny.
Exactly. And so that's why it's important to check in. And this happens internally with me. and affects my pleasure at work or displeasure at work, and then it impacts my family and then the people of my colleagues, how I speak to a nurse, how I get upset with a patient.
Right, the quality of care that you are committed to. Things.
And so it moves out, and then it moves out into my community, and then it moves out into the larger world, and we're all doing this. And
right.
So all these ripples of fear spread through the world, and they compete with the ripples of love that we spread through the world as well. When I take time at the end of the day, before I go to sleep, I kiss Anne goodnight, and then I take moments and I check in with myself and say, who's in there? What kind of day did you have? Anybody have anything to say?
How did we do?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a we. And, it is a we.
And so sometimes, or I'll bookmark things that happen. So somebody does something, or I'll be watching TV, and just you spoke about a political event today that's upsetting you. And so, I got to the point when we invaded Iraq that I couldn't even look at George Bush on the television. And this is a political statement. But now that the reverse happened with Obama, and the same thing happened, I saw conservatives respond to President Obama exactly the same way, and I realized that this has so little to do with them. They're doing the best they can.
Right.
It has
right.
to do with me.
Right.
And so to be able to go back and say, who is that inside of me? And, and so that, to find out what that is, so I can listen to my president and hear the good things that he's doing and be able to disagree and, cast my vote in an adult way, as opposed to having the vitriol all the time, which is not good for me.
That's what I was going to say. It takes a toll on us.
And it spreads negativity.
Yes,
and
yes.
So we're seeing the consequence. We're seeing the consequence of that unbridled fear all through our politics right now and also in the world. I remember when President Ahmadinejad from Iran said that the Holocaust never happened. And of course, you can imagine the Jews around the world, how they felt about him, and what the Israelis felt about him. They were incensed about it, and rightly so.
It's unconscionable.
It's unconscionable, but I think at the same time, what he was saying was, how does it feel? How does it feel, Israelis, when I say to you, your pain isn't real, it's made up, it's manufactured, how do you think the Palestinians feel by your actions?
Bam.
Same
Bam.
Thing.
Yeah.
And so,
yes.
And so, I'm Jewish, and I'm after World War II and the Holocaust, I was thrilled that my people had a safe place to go. But it's been at a cost, and it seems that there's no room for us to step back and say, let me hear your pain. Let me acknowledge your pain.
No room for that.
No
room for that.
Because we have to be protective.
Right.
We're
fighting for what's right in our minds. We're fighting for what's right.
Yes. And being right is more important than sharing love and sharing...
Right, and trying to find common ground. There's two observations I want to reflect here that hit me when reading the book and while you're saying this. First of all, I was thinking when I was reading the book, why do we have to do all this stuff? Life seemed to be much simpler at one point. And you know what? It was. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have email. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have two parents working. The whole world that I grew up in, there's pretty much none of it. And I am so serious. Life truly was simpler. There wasn't email to check on Saturdays and Sundays. It was family time. So much of that has changed. So to me, the voices and the ability to cope with it are something for a changing world. And when you look at our society, people are hurting. We have substance abuse out the wazoo. We have so many people locked up. We have people in therapy, people depressed. Suicides are at an all-time high. So to me, your book is important because it gives some sense to it. It's why we are here and what we can do. And the other reflection I have is I used to think of meditation as the biggest, oh my gosh, I can't keep quiet, I can't keep my brain still. And I have evolved to the point where meditation takes on many forms, and it's stopping to reflect and think, which you think, oh yeah, we all do that. Well, no, we really don't. I'm like you. It's like, how did I come with this 12-hour day again when I said I'm only going to be out one night a week, I want to be home with James, blah, blah, blah. And just taking stock and being quiet and listening. So it's not some heavy-duty emotional and spiritual practice we have to do. It's a check-in.
No, that's right. And sometimes, I in the book, I try to show the humor in, you know, listening to myself, because sometimes I'm completely surprised at what I hear. I mean, I think I know everything that's inside
yes.
of me.
And yes, so I asked, it's delightful I check in with to myself, say that, yeah.
And, I ask a question, and the answer I get back is, we're tired tonight. Just go to sleep.
Dude, leave me alone.
Leave me alone.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a long day.
Yeah.
And other times, you know, I hear I'm totally surprised and in a humorous way about, you know, it's completely what I don't expect.
It's a really great process that can just only benefit the individual,
right.
Which is where the work really begins.
And it's not that I had really good parents, and they sacrificed for me to have good education. They taught me, I mean, they really mentored me to live in the world. I mean, I made my bed, I scrubbed floors, I balanced checkbooks. I knew how to add and subtract. I was serving customers at our garden mart when I was 12 years old. I mean, they trained me to be in the world. The fact that they weren't able to deal with my emotional, my emotional pain and listen in that way, you know, that's just because of who they were and how they grew up.
And you thanked them in the book, and this was insightful, and I probably can't find the quote exactly, but I did write it down, and I might do it, you know, a little, I might brutalize it a little bit, but you can bring me back on track. And you said, through this process, you thank them for all that they gave you and for all that they couldn't, because there's learning in that, and that's very much like my journey. They did the best with what they had. And sometimes it hurt, and sometimes it wasn't enough. But because of that, other things put you on your own journey.
Correct.
Is that
yes.
reflective and, of the message?
And fortunately, this happened early enough in my life, so I was able to parent differently.
Yes. And, oh my gosh, same listened, for me. Yeah.
Listen to my children in a way that I wouldn't have been able to.
I agree. I totally agree. And I shared with you, and I've said this before, you know, my mother was spare the rod and spoil the child. That's how she was raised, in a very harsh way by her father. And then so she thought that being a good parent was to at times beat it out of you. And there was a belt. When you talked about those four belts up there that were hung, the straps, I'm like, oh my God, I got the strap. So that process of forgiving her, and she lived long enough for us to talk about it. It's what she knew, and she was doing it because she thought she was a good parent, that she was going to teach me what was really important, to keep my mouth shut or to not be fresh or, you know, to not lie or whatever. She did the best with what she had. So that, you know, to me, that was a big revelation of forgiving her and understanding.
Right.
Okay, so here's my big question.
Okay.
Does that person exist out there that had the parents who had it all together? They took all the right classes. They learned from their mistakes. There weren't these voices, these experiences in childhood. Are there people out there that might be listening to this and saying, I don't know what they're talking about because I had the perfect childhood?
You know, in the, they, they, in the psychological world, they talk about good enough parents. And fortunately for 60-70% of us, we had good enough parents.
Yes, that's a great way to put it.
And we parents make mistakes. And if we don't have to be perfect as parents, then we can allow our children to raise their fist and protest. And we can say, I'm sorry, you're right.
I think that's huge.
Yeah, it is huge. And on the flip side, we can't feel guilty for our mistakes and let our kids get away, you know, and spoil them and make them narcissists because we feel guilty. We have to be able to say, no, this isn't okay. You know, that you have some responsibilities. You're accountable. You can have your feelings, but you're responsible for your feelings and your actions based on those feelings. It's not okay when you're angry to hit your sister.
Right, right.
And so, you know, it's not about all letting it all hang out. It's about, it's the combination of unconditional love, which is I accept you for the way you interpret the world. You're allowed to interpret the world your way. We'll talk about it. And maybe I'll show you another way to look at it if you want, but you get to interpret the world your way. And on the other hand, there's discipline, there's mentoring, there's setting appropriate limits, and teaching children that the difference between a healthy child and a healthy adult is a healthy adult doesn't throw a temper tantrum in the middle of Safeway,
right,
underneath the M&Ms.
Right.
You know, that the healthy adult, you know, learns, has their appropriate time to say, okay, I'm furious, I've got to get this out in a safe way because I don't want to hurt somebody and I don't want to humiliate myself. I don't want to get fired because a six-year-old is angry at a television show.
Right. So there is the learning there on both sides. I mean,
yes.
That's what I thought was interesting. And, you know, your book, like, it was piercing little arrows into my psyche in a very good way. Like, good. And when you described your relationship with your grandmother and how important that was for you because she loved you unconditionally. And I thought back, and I think I had great parents. I really do. And most of my childhood memories are very happy, and I felt loved and safe and all those things. But did my parents love me unconditionally? And the answer I came up with was no, they didn't. That's hard for a parent anyway. And I came up with the person. It was like my Uncle Charlie. He's the one that gave me the name Queenie. And so when I'm sharing this with everyone, because this is a journey that I believe everybody wants to take, and it's worth it when you do. And I smiled, and he died at a very young age. He was an alcoholic, but I was his Queenie. And when he was coming down the street, you know, I was the third child out of four. Uncle Charlie's coming, and I ruled the roost here because I could do no wrong. And I had a fresh mouth and, you know, on and on. My sister was a goody two-shoes, and he loved my spunk. So I could be me. So there
exactly.
Is that person.
And, all we need is one person that has a twinkle in their eye every time we come by.
Yes. That's what he did.
And so over these years, as I've begun my spiritual practice, which is kind of a meditative practice, checking in with myself, I think I can safely say that I give those young voices, they see a twinkle in my eye each time we connect.
And the person who benefits the most is you, but it has the ripple effect.
It does.
If mom's happy, everyone's happy. Well, that's just ridiculous. If I'm happy, those around me, there's an energetic that is just a ripple effect for each of us. And, you know, we don't have time to get into some of the things, the parallels you draw between the need for us to do this. And when you talk about how many children, I was just blown away by the global impact of what you're talking about with Save the Children and the number of children living in orphanages around the world, and perhaps as many as 100 million, according to UNICEF, that are orphaned or abandoned. And maybe we'll get you back. I know you're still busy and you haven't retired, but to talk more about the impact this will have for generations to come, because how do you parent if you were never parented? That's a big, bold question. And I just think we're going to end with that, because it's like this show could be the marathon 3-hour show with the Larry and Gina show, because there's much more to talk about. But I do want to end with a heartfelt thanks, because it really did have an impact on my life. And I don't believe it's going to be a 3-day kumbaya rah-rah workshop. It's a book I'll keep close. And it's a book I'll share with my children and act differently in some situations to stop and ask. So you made the difference in the life of this child and adult. And I'm very appreciative of that.
Well, that makes me very happy.
It's the God's honest truth, and you could tell. And when you came in, I said, in 12 years or 10 years, I have never written 4 pages of questions that just kept coming out of me. What about this and what about that? And obviously, it sparked something in me that was meaningful and important for my work on this path, so I don't burn myself out.
I want to thank, before we end, I want to thank Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Oh, right.
What a blessing she was in my life.
To the world.
Many lives. And thank TMC, because TMC, Tucson Medical Center, sponsored the Growth and Transition Workshops for 31 years.
And I'm sorry that I can't go to the last one, but there'll be other trainers that hopefully it will come about for people that are on a journey of self-discovery and growth and want to do the best and be the best that they can be. I want to thank them too, because they make shows like this possible. So our coming up shows on September 27th, Tim, I don't know how to say his last name, and I'm going to get in trouble, but it's Tom Muir, I believe, kicking off a series with Tucson Water, the Innovators. It's going to be a great show and important for our local scene. And September 26th, Marisol Flores, Aguirre Amit Arker, and Leslie Obiara, Microlending for Economic and Social Justice, the Power of International Partnerships. I promise you it's going to be a great and impactful show. So Larry, once again, thanks for the work, and thanks for showing up in my world. It made a difference for me.
Thank you for having me.
Go out and get the book, everybody. It's on Amazon, and make it a great, green, intentionally lived week.